In April 1971, a long-haired American table tennis player accidentally boarded a Chinese team bus in Japan and sparked one of history's most unexpected diplomatic breakthroughs. Within days, the U.S. team became the first official American delegation to visit Communist China since 1949, ending 22 years of isolation between the nations. This ping-pong diplomacy captured global headlines and paved the way for President Nixon's historic visit to China the following year. What most observers didn't realize was that this seemingly spontaneous sporting exchange had deeper roots, orchestrated in part by Ivor Montague, a British aristocrat who had spent decades building table tennis into a vehicle for communist influence. Nicholas Griffin's fascinating account reveals how a simple parlor game became entangled with espionage, revolution, and geopolitics, ultimately helping to reshape the Cold War world order. The story reminds us that sometimes the most profound political transformations begin not with summit meetings or military maneuvers, but with the gentle tap of a small white ball. Born into one of England's wealthiest Jewish banking families in 1904, Ivor Montague seemed destined for a life of aristocratic privilege. While his athletic brothers excelled at traditional sports, young Ivor found his niche in table tennis, convincing his father to install a table on their London home's landing, the same table where government ministers gathered for bridge games. This early passion would become his lifelong cover for revolutionary activities. At Westminster School, Montague led a fascinating double life, wearing the required Eton suit to class, then changing into a working-class cap afterward. His political awakening came through George Bernard Shaw's Socialism for Millionaires, and by 15 he had declared himself a pacifist. During one protest, he struck down a policeman with his silver-headed ebony cane, knowing his aristocratic status would shield him from suspicion. At Cambridge, Montague neglected academics for politics, art, sport, and new friends. After failing at other sports, he ordered custom ping-pong tables and organized a tournament that drew 140 players. Soon he was chairing the National Ping-Pong Association and writing rules that would remain intact for 40 years. When manufacturers claimed trademark rights to ping-pong, Montague simply dissolved the association and reformed it as the Table Tennis Association, his first victory against capitalism. By his early 20s, Montague was living a remarkable double life. While establishing the Film Society in London to screen high art films alongside communist propaganda, he made his first trip to Russia, ostensibly as a zoologist seeking the Prometheus mouse, but actually to connect with Soviet leadership. His father pleaded with him over juicy roast beef and crackly roast potatoes not to go, warning of banking informants and plague, but Montague was undeterred. In Moscow, Montague found Soviet Russia intoxicating. He collected hunting licenses, secured films, viewed Lenin's corpse, attended the Bolshoi Ballet, and visited film studios. His zoological expedition proved disastrous. The voles he collected fought until few remained, and escapees required Russian soldiers to help recapture them. By the time he reached London, all his specimens had died. Upon returning to England, Montague deepened his communist connections while simultaneously building a career in British cinema, working closely with Alfred Hitchcock on classic spy films like The 39 Steps. The unlikely pair would work late into the night, with Hitchcock clutching his plotting primer while the unassuming Montague, now a little tubby around the middle, black glasses halfway down his nose, advised on weaving outlandish plots into ordinary settings. Throughout this period, British intelligence suspected Montague's communist activities, but focused on the wrong areas. When he used film to spread communism, they investigated his table tennis activities. When he used table tennis to spread communism, they investigated his film society. And when he actually spied for the Soviets, they missed it entirely. By 1926, Montague had transformed table tennis from a frivolous parlor game into a legitimate international sport. Using 300 from his grandfather's inheritance, he converted London's Memorial Hall into an arena for what began as a European championship, but was quickly elevated to a world championship when participants from India arrived. The event drew over 10,000 spectators, proving table tennis was more than just a parlor game. Montague's parents were initially pleased to see their son engaged in something non-political. His mother paid for the championship cup, while his father selected a fine, fat-bellied design in Old English style from the family bank's bullion room. The trophy, costing £35, was named the Swathling Cup. The International Table Tennis Federation was founded in the library of the Montague family home, with 22-year-old Ivor elected president, a position he would hold for over 40 years. Despite this success, the sport faced ridicule from the press, with the Times suggesting using a curtain rod instead of a net, while another paper mockingly compared it to tiddlywinks. By 1937, Montague had secured the king as patron of the English Table Tennis Association. The sport had gained royal approval. The king played regularly in Buckingham Palace and had perfected a special shot of his own, declared by those who have been his opponents to be unplayable. The queen showed interest in table tennis equipment at exhibitions, while Queen Mary was a regular visitor to the Montague household. But for Montague, table tennis was always more than just a sport. It was a political crusade, an inexpensive game accessible to the working class that would later serve as perfect cover for his communist activities. During the Spanish Civil War, Montague produced pro-Soviet documentaries on the front lines, carrying letters from high-ranking Soviet agents. In one dangerous moment captured on film, he examined an unexploded German shell to prove Nazi support for Franco, then accidentally threw himself directly onto it when another shell exploded nearby. One of my luckier and certainly one of my more foolish moments. Though many viewed Montague as a naive idealist, he was fully committed to communism despite witnessing its violence. From his first Moscow visit, he involved himself with communist leadership, excusing bloodshed as inevitable in service to the greater cause. To him, betraying family or country meant little compared to betraying the people. When Edgar Snow trekked through mountains to reach Mao Zedong's revolutionary base in 1936, he discovered ping-pong tables in every Lenin club, often serving double duty as dining tables. The game was played by everyone from soldiers to top leaders, including Zhao Enlai, Mao himself, and the legendary Zhu Dai, founder of the People's Liberation Army. When foreign visitors asked what supplies were needed, communist leaders requested ping-pong balls above luxuries like candy or cigarettes, promising there would be no end of joy. After the communist victory in China, table tennis became a national priority. By 1950, Montague saw it as the perfect cultural bridge to communist China and secretly initiated correspondence, eager to make the ITTF the first international organization to welcome them. The Chinese hesitated, concerned about losing and bringing shame to New China. When China finally joined the ITTF, they immediately established their position that Taiwan could only participate as Taiwan Province of the People's Republic of China, a strategy dictated by Zhou Enlai himself. Meanwhile, in post-war Japan, 17-year-old Ichiro Ogi Ogimura approached table tennis with fanatical dedication. He ran daily, carrying a stone matching his racket's weight, studied spin at billiard parlors, and carried the Book of Five Rings by Japan's master swordsman, mentally translating its strategies to table tennis. In 1952, as Japan signed the San Francisco Peace Treaty ending American occupation, Ogi watched as Hiroji Sato, using a revolutionary sponge-covered racket that silenced the ball, won the world championship in Bombay. Later that year, Ogi won his first All-Japan Championship, celebrating with his first beer and a smile that would last as long as he kept winning. Preparing for the 1954 World Championships, Ogi intensified his training, hopping 4 kilometers with a 40-kilogram dumbbell and perfecting his serving accuracy by repeatedly knocking down pen lids. Despite financial struggles that forced him to beg on Tokyo's streets for funds, he made it to London, where he faced intense anti-Japanese sentiment. Restaurants emptied when he entered, barbers refused service, and crowds booed the Japanese team. Undeterred, Ogi implemented his 51% doctrine of aggressive play, leading Japan to victory over favorites Hungary and then England, winning both team and singles titles. His continued dominance in subsequent championships demonstrated how table tennis had become a potent symbol of the country's post-war reconstruction, a lesson closely observed by the Chinese team. Rong Guotan's meeting with two Chinese marshals, Chen Yi and He Long, revealed the extraordinary interest China's leadership had in table tennis. Despite Hong Kong's rejection of Rong for their Asian Championship squad, he chose to move north to Communist China. Unlike most returning Chinese who faced 9 months of political re-education, Rong received special treatment, living in Chiang Kai-shek's former residence, earning top rank status and pay, and receiving excellent medical care for his tuberculosis. At the 1959 Dortmund World Championships, Rong appeared almost schoolboyish in his long black trousers and red-collared t-shirt. His spring-like playing style helped him defeat American Dick Miles in a tense semi-final before facing Hungary's veteran Ferenc Szeto in the final. The physical opposites, tubercular, thin Rong versus wrestler-like Szeto, battled under a single bright light in the center of darkness. Rong methodically outplayed Szeto, becoming China's first champion in any sport. Zhao Enlai celebrated Rong's victory, noting that while he as premier couldn't travel everywhere, ping pong players can go anywhere in the world. Mao personally congratulated Rong, calling table tennis China's spiritual nuclear weapon, even as troubling agricultural reports from the Great Leap Forward were beginning to emerge. By 1961, China had developed a formidable table tennis program, gathering 108 of its best players for winter training, a symbolic number matching the 108 heroes from the water margin who fought against corrupt emperors. These elite players were isolated in special training facilities in Shanghai, Guangdong, and Beijing, selected from tournaments involving millions across the nation. They lived in a 7-story dormitory near the Temple of Heaven, with special facilities, regular meals with meat, and complete dedication to the state. While famine ravaged China during the Great Leap Forward, the National Sports Commission kept the ping pong team well fed through creative means, sending the international shooting team to hunt yellow goats in Inner Mongolia to barter for eggs. Their punishing schedule began at 6 a.m. with exercises and weight training, followed by 3-hour table tennis sessions morning and afternoon, with little free time. The players trained before packed stadiums with orchestrated audience responses, while being acutely aware of the famine affecting their relatives outside their privileged bubble. To boost morale, Marshal He Long once interrupted practice to share battlefield stories, removing his teeth to show where he'd been shot in the mouth during a cavalry charge. The Cultural Revolution struck like lightning after the distant thunder of the Great Leap Forward. Mao's strategy involved speaking in vague aphorisms while pitting the old guard, led by Zhou Enlai, against young radicals, led by his wife Zhang Qing, claiming revisionists lurked at every level of leadership. He floated above the conflict he orchestrated like a man walking two dogs that despised each other. When the table tennis team returned from Sweden, they found Zhu Yinsheng arrested, their dorm rooms emptied, and the kitchen closed, though a teammate casually mentioned, "Every restaurant's opened its doors, everything's free." Across China, students formed Red Guard units, violence erupted against authority figures, and millions traveled to Beijing seeking Mao's blessing. The National Sports Commission was overrun with Red Guards, sleeping on and under table tennis tables. Japanese coach Ogimura, visiting during this period, witnessed factory managers paraded through streets in dunce caps, school principals covered in student spittle, and classical records smashed as part of destroying the four olds: old culture, habits, customs, and ideas. Mao's image and quotations appeared everywhere, on handlebars, trees, loudspeakers, even carved into hillsides. As the Cultural Revolution intensified, Mao became its center, drawing millions of Red Guards to Beijing. Though the national table tennis squad had split into factions, some players maintained loyalty despite pressure. Liang Jialong couldn't betray Zhuang Zedong, who had personally helped him find treatment for his mother's cancer. Red Guards raided Zhuang's home, ransacking every drawer and shelf, reading his private letters, and confiscating all his possessions. They destroyed calligraphy, broke antiques, and tore up family photographs, anything representing the condemned Four Olds. The Cultural Revolution created a perilous political landscape where being without a patron left one vulnerable. The table tennis squad's protectors were systematically weakened. He Long, who had never liked Mao's wife Jiang Qing, faced her retribution when she publicly called him a traitor. Despite Zhou Enlai moving He Long to a safe house, Red Guards discovered his hideout. At 69 and diabetic, he was subjected to struggle sessions, beaten under blankets to hide welts, denied insulin, and eventually died from untreated diabetes in 1969. As Xi Enting marched through Beijing's midnight streets chanting Mao's slogans and performing loyalty dances while dragging a heavy cart of propaganda posters, he mourned his wasting athletic prime. "I felt like a piece of bamboo that somebody kept cutting back every time it started to grow," he lamented. By 1969, tensions between China and the Soviet Union had reached a dangerous point. After a deadly border clash along the Ussuri River, Soviet officials approached Henry Kissinger about China's provocations, but he dismissed their concerns. Nixon and Kissinger recognized an opening. The Soviets and Chinese now feared each other more than America. Rather than greenlighting Soviet nuclear strikes against China in exchange for ending Soviet support of North Vietnam, Nixon chose a bolder strategy, rapprochement with China. Nixon and Kissinger established a secret back channel through Pakistan to communicate directly with Zhou Enlai, bypassing the State Department. Their messages traveled via handwritten notes in sealed envelopes carried by diplomatic pouch. Throughout 1970, subtle signals were exchanged. Nixon using People's Republic in speeches, China lifting restrictions on American oil companies, and passport restrictions easing. By early 1971, communication had stalled, leaving Kissinger anxiously waiting for a response while preparing for potential détente. The next breakthrough would come not through diplomatic channels, but through an unexpected cultural avenue, table tennis. The 1971 World Table Tennis Championships were scheduled for Nagoya, Japan. Zhou Enlai faced diplomatic challenges with both Japan and the United States, as China lacked official relations with either country. Zhou made his terms clear. China would participate in Nagoya only if Japan abandoned support for Taiwan and rejected the two-China solution. Zhou was using the supposedly non-political sport to effect political change. When Zhou asked the Chinese team if they wanted to compete in Japan, most voted to stay home, indoctrinated to believe there was nothing to learn from foreigners. Ultimately, Mao himself made the decision, writing a note wishing them luck while ominously telling them to prepare for death, and adding to Zhou, "We should be prepared to lose a few people. Of course, it will be better if we don't." On April 5, Glenn Cowan, a long-haired American player with counterculture sensibilities, boarded what he thought was a shuttle bus, only to find himself surrounded by the Chinese team. After breaking the awkward silence with revolutionary rhetoric, Zhuang Zedong approached him with a silkscreen portrait of the Huangshan Mountains. Their encounter caught Chairman Mao's attention, who remarked, "Zhuang Zedong, he's a good diplomat as well," and immediately increased the team's daily communications with Beijing from 3 to 5 times. The next day, Cowan purchased 2 t-shirts with peace symbols and "Let It Be" printed on them. When he presented one to Zhuang, cameras captured their embrace. Though portrayed by the press as a spontaneous gesture between innocents, Henry Kissinger would later suspect the friendship had been meticulously planned to appear spontaneous. Song Zhong, former military intelligence analyst and general secretary of China's National Sports Commission, became Zhou Enlai's point man in Nagoya. His mission: orchestrate inviting the U.S. team while making it appear the Americans had requested it. The final decision to invite the Americans rested with Chairman Mao himself. Initially endorsing a recommendation to decline, the 74-year-old Mao changed his mind that night after taking sleeping pills. Despite his nurse's concerns about decisions made while medicated, Mao insisted, "Invite the American team to China. Do it quickly, otherwise there won't be time." When news broke about the American team's invitation to China, Bill Cunningham, the China specialist at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, found a buried sentence in Nixon's foreign relations report stating the U.S. was open to educational, cultural, and athletic exchanges with People's Republic of China. Based on these 16 words, and without knowing about Nixon and Kissinger's secret outreach efforts, Cunningham made the crucial decision that the team's visit would not be against United States policy. In Nagoya, American team captain Graham Steenhoven met with Song Zhong in a windowless room beneath the stadium to discuss logistics. The Americans were woefully unprepared. As team member Tim Boggan admitted, "We were all nincompoops. None of us knew what we were doing." Most still believed the invitation was simply about ping pong rather than diplomacy. The media frenzy began in Hong Kong, where journalists pursued the team relentlessly. With no Western journalists allowed into China, news outlets recruited team members as impromptu reporters, providing cameras and crash courses in journalism. Cowan crossed into China wearing his signature outfit, Let It Be shirt, yellow floppy hat, and purple tie-dye pants, deliberately lagging behind for photographers. The team walked across the border bridge to music playing from the sky, feeling like they were in a movie. Cowan's photograph waving goodbye to the Western world made front pages globally, appearing alongside Vietnam War news, a coincidence Zhou Enlai couldn't have planned better. The American press coverage was enormous, multiple daily articles in the New York Times, while Chinese coverage remained bland and equal for all visiting teams. Zhou Enlai escalated matters by suddenly granting visas to veteran American journalists. The team's meeting with Zhou Enlai marked the diplomatic pinnacle, with Zhou declaring they had opened a new page in the relations of the Chinese and American people. Cowan, the first person in purple bell-bottom trousers received by Mr. Zhou, boldly asked about the hippie movement, prompting Zhou to philosophically respond that youth wants to seek the truth, and when we were young, it was the same. In summer 1971, Henry Kissinger executed an elaborate deception, feigning illness in Pakistan while secretly flying to Beijing with a small American delegation. The mission culminated months of diplomatic maneuvering that had begun when the Chinese invited the American ping pong team. When Kissinger's plane descended into Beijing, he carried enormous potential, hastening the end of the Vietnam War, bringing the Soviets to heel, and drawing 800 million Chinese out of isolation. In his meetings with Zhou Enlai, both men displayed deep knowledge of geopolitics and shared suspicion of Russia. Zhou noted with satisfaction that throwing a ping pong ball has thrown the Soviet Union into such consternation. When Nixon arrived in China in February 1972, he brought the largest advance team in presidential history. The banquet Zhou Enlai hosted for Nixon garnered the second largest television audience in American history after the moon landing. The frail Mao met with Nixon within hours of his arrival. To enter Mao's room, visitors walked past a table tennis table. During their conversation, Mao acknowledged Nixon's wisdom in wanting to meet rather than letting Taiwan permanently separate them. "I saw you were right, and we played ping pong." In spring 1972, the Chinese table tennis team toured America with tight security. The delegation received welcome gifts, including maps, Audubon books, and Polaroid cameras. The one translator called the camera demonstration an awkward, naked commercial pitch. The Chinese visitors were initially apprehensive, with Xinhua news agency members, some undercover security, carrying weapons. They were surprised by America's abundance, malls with hundreds of cars, enormous supermarkets, and hardware stores with sidewalk displays. This contradicted their education that America was ruled by a few rich people over desperate masses. For the individual players who made history, life after ping-pong diplomacy took dramatically different paths. Glen Cowan's fame peaked quickly after the China trip and faded just as rapidly. Initially, he leveraged his celebrity into media appearances, including spots with Johnny Carson and Dinah Shore. But his success was short-lived. Diagnosed variously as bipolar and schizophrenic, he developed paranoid delusions about Russian spies planting stuff in his head. His condition worsened every April, the anniversary of the China trip. He died on April 6, 2004, the eve of the 33rd anniversary of the China invitation, with no obituaries in major newspapers. Zhuang Zedong's path contrasted sharply with Cowan's, initially more successful, but ultimately more terrifying. By 1974, he had risen to become Minister of Sport and Physical Culture and a member of the Communist Party's Central Committee. Yet he became aligned with Mao's wife, Jiang Qing, and her Gang of Four. When they fell from power, Zhuang was exiled to Shaanxi in 1980, beginning his new life as a street sweeper. He was finally allowed to return to Beijing in 1984 to teach in a local sports school. Before his death in 2013, Zhuang claimed, "The Cold War ended with me," acknowledging the deliberate strategy behind his famous meeting with Glen Cowan. For all his political missteps, he understood what it meant to represent a nation. If I won, the whole country won. If I lost, China lost. 90 years earlier, Montagu had championed table tennis as a weapon for peace, a sport perfectly suited to communism's ideals. It could be played in cramped factories, was both humanistic and competitive, and exercised mind and body alike. Yet he watched the 1971 ping-pong diplomacy from the sidelines, as the sport he had placed in Chinese hands, when China was aligned with Russia, became the vehicle for American-Chinese rapprochement. In his final years, Montagu published an autobiography covering only his first 23 years. When asked for a second volume, he merely rewrote the first, though his rejected manuscript hinted at his Comintern connections. He occasionally emerged to praise Mao or welcome Chinese table tennis teams to England, but mostly lived quietly, described in his Who's Who entry as enjoying washing up, pottering about, sleeping through television. To his great-niece Nicole, perhaps the only relative to reconnect with him after the family split, he was a warm, gentle man in a green cardigan with tufty hair, patiently discussing world injustices over tea. When his wife Hel died in 1984, Ivor followed 2 weeks later, dying on Guy Fawkes Day. Though barely noted in British obituaries, Chinese officials declared, "The Chinese people will never forget Ivor Montagu." The story of ping-pong diplomacy reveals how seemingly minor cultural exchanges can sometimes achieve what traditional diplomacy cannot. A sport that began as a Victorian parlor game became, through the machinations of an aristocratic communist spy, a vehicle for revolutionary politics and eventually a bridge between hostile superpowers. The small white ball that bounced between Glen Cowan and Zhuang Zedong in Nagoya helped change the trajectory of the Cold War and reshape international relations for decades to come. Though 300 million Chinese still play table tennis, its political significance has diminished. Once China's first foothold toward international respect, table tennis now remains a living fossil like the horseshoe crab, a perfect specimen from a volatile era, while a richer China explores a boundless horizon of other sports. Yet the legacy of those historic matches endures, reminding us that sometimes the most effective diplomacy happens not in formal negotiations, but in unexpected moments of human connection across seemingly unbridgeable divides.